Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. A special bonus episode of the podcast, where Professor Tony Bates describing the likely impact of COVID-19 on the future of higher education. Tony's student-centered advice mentions several important considerations for changing teaching methods, planning for improvement, and education systems. It's my pleasure to be talking again with our very first leader and legend of online learning, Dr. Tony Bates. Tony's president and CEO of Tony Bates Associates Limited and is well known across the world for his services to online education. He's an international consultant well known for his insightful commentary and also for his free book, Teaching in a Digital Age. Tony, thanks for joining me for this conversation about higher education in a post-COVID world. And I'm sorry we can't have this conversation over a pint.
Yeah, well, that's the way it is these days, I'm afraid.
So, Tony, the COVID-19 pandemic is really an event unprecedented across current generations. It's already caused almost 350,000 deaths worldwide as we record this. It's closed campuses, it's caused multiple job losses, and it's disrupted social engagement and economies unlike anything in living memory. You've been very active recently supporting educators to move online, and you've also developed a webinar series considering how higher education might respond. Can you perhaps give an overview of the work you've recently been doing?
Well, I've been tracking online learning through an organization called the Canadian Digital Learning Research Association. We've been tracking the enrollments in online learning for the last 3 years up to 2020. And what we saw was a gradual increase, a fairly small number, but still significant, about 8% to 10% of all course enrollments in Canada for degree programs and college diploma programs are fully online. So it's a small but significant area. And it was increasing at roughly 10% per annum over the last few years. And this is the trend. The numbers are slightly different, but the trend is in line with what's happening in the United States as well. They probably have a slightly higher proportion of online students than we do in Canada, but not by much. So it was chugging along quite nicely until COVID-19. And then, of course, everybody suddenly has to go online again. So one of the things I think that's going to happen is that when we get into a kind of post-COVID-19 paranormal, I will call it, because I don't think it will be quite the same normal, but it will not be as severe as it is at the moment. I think we're going to see a little kick in fully online learning. As a result, a lot of courses will stay online if faculty find they work well online. But I don't think it's going to be a huge kick in fully online learning. I think it's going to go up to about maybe 20% of all enrollments. And that's because there's going to be an increasing demand for lifelong learning because of the economy, people wanting to come back and get more qualifications and so on and keep up to date in whatever area they're working in. So we will have some increase in online learning anyway, and that will be demand driven. But the big change is going to come really on the campus teaching, because I think a lot of faculty will have realized that a lot of things that they do or don't do on campus can be done actually as well, if not better, online. Yeah. And they'll start integrating that into their campus teaching. So I see a huge jump in what's, let's call it, blended learning. And that, to me, has some major implications because, again, to really exploit blended learning, you've got to change your teaching method. It's not good enough just to keep delivering lectures either online or in class and then try to find something to do online. I think it's almost going to be flipped. People will start saying, well, let's see how much we can push online, and then let's look at what we can really do well on campus that maybe is not so well done online. And that will, of course, vary from subject to subject. I think in STEM, we'll see still quite a lot of lab work and so on. But even in those areas, we're seeing things now like simulations, virtual reality, and virtual engineering, of course, which is it's what's happening. It's not just teaching virtually. It's actually happening virtually in engineering now. So I think the blended learning element will increase a great deal. And that, of course, puts a lot more pressure on faculty on their teaching skills and their knowledge of how best to use technology. And I think that's the big challenge for institutions now, is how do you scale up that support for faculty that was okay when it was, say, 10% or 20% for fully online? How do you scale it up to the whole campus? And I think that's going to be the big challenge. I was very interested to see in a university in Canada that has some online learning, but it's never been very much engaged in it. It was already about to get 5% to 6% cuts in its operating budget, suddenly going ahead and hiring 10 instructional designers. Now, that to me is a clear indication that institutions are not thinking that their rush to online is just temporary, but it's going to be more permanent. So I think we will see what I would call digital learning increasing a great deal more as a result of COVID-19.
Yeah. So just thinking on that, you mentioned the hiring of 10 new instructional designers, universities moving online, how to support faculty who are now dealing with blended learning. It sounds as though things are actually going to become a lot more expensive. So are we adding cost here? Are we really improving the viability of these institutions by taking these moves?
Well, I don't think we can take the model that we've had for supporting online, fully online learning, and move that for the supporting the whole of the university. That has two implications. One, we have to have much better faculty development programs. I think the current model of faculty development is broken. Only 10% of faculty in any one year take a faculty development program in Canada, and that's optional. And it's often the same 10%, and often faculty development offices tell me it's the ones who least need it because they're the best teachers. So what do we do about that other 90%? Now, what is interesting is we're seeing a lot more faculty taking crash courses on how to get the courses online because they realize they need help to do this during COVID-19. But what I think we should have for university professors and college professors and instructors is what they have in many other organizations, and that's an individual learning plan for each faculty member about what they're going to be learning over the next year in terms of their teaching. And now I know we'll get all kinds of cries about academic freedom and so on, but I don't think it's unreasonable to ask faculty to maintain and update their training in teaching, because we wouldn't allow somebody to fly a plane without keeping up to date. So why would we allow professors to teach without keeping up to date with the changes that are happening in technology? And as a result, I don't think we're ever going to go back, actually, to where we were before, because I think the threat of a virus of this kind, it's going to take 2 years to get a vaccine out to everybody. Even if we do get a vaccine for it, there's likely to be variations on it. So I think all universities and colleges will need some kind of plan for dealing with flare-ups and emergencies and so on of all kinds, not just necessarily health ones. I can think of in the US certainly closing down campuses because of terrorism and so on, and in other countries due to natural events like earthquakes and so on. So every institution really is going to have a plan, and that means having in place a fairly robust system for moving online.
These are very significant things you're talking about. I mean, none of them is a small initiative. So I wonder if we can talk now just in terms of three different layers of implication here. So there's often talk of the micro, meso, and macro. So the educator, the university, and the whole education system. Should we take one of those three on and move on to the other two?
I'd rather like to start with the student, actually, and what it means for students. And it's ironic to me that the real concern at the moment is the very large first-year lecture classes. And the question is, how on earth do you deal with that when you've got the coronavirus in the community? And so I guess the reflex action is to move those courses online. But they're probably those first-year students are the least appropriate students to go online for all kinds of reasons. They actually want the social aspects of a campus, and they're probably not very good independent learners to start with, and they're buying into something that's not what they really want. And I think that's a big issue for universities particularly. I think it's less of an issue for vocational colleges and so on. And my worry is we could end up with a two-tier system where we have, when everything has calmed down, we'll have two kinds of programs. We'll have expensive on-campus programs with all the hoopla and sports and activities and so on, and then lower cost online programs for those who can't afford the full campus experience. And I think that would be, you know, moving completely in the wrong direction, but I can see that as a possibility. So what I think institutions need is some kind of policy or strategy about where it should focus its online activities. And also, I think they really need to re-examine those very large first-year lecture classes, which are not very good when they're done face-to-face. You need a brilliant lecturer who can lecture brilliantly, not just once, but all the way through the course, to make those classes really work. And what I think we're going to have to see is what I would call curriculum redesign, which will take account of what I was saying about blended learning, for instance, and how you redesign your teaching. And there are other reasons for doing this anyway. If we look at what's happening in the economy, we're seeing greater demand for skills, particularly skills like communication skills, critical thinking, and so on. So we need to focus our teaching more on skills development than content presentation. Now, lectures are great for content presentation, except there's a lot of research going back 30, 40 years about cognitive overload, suggesting that they're not a very efficient way to deliver content. But in particular, we need to be getting students to do what I call knowledge management, that is, knowing where to look for, find, evaluate, and apply information in a world where information is expanding exponentially. So we need to change our teaching methods, whatever, whether we had coronavirus or not. And so I think it is an opportunity to examine some bad practices that we have in our on-campus teaching that we need to get rid of if we're going to have an effective set of learning outcomes for our students.
It's incredibly difficult for universities to move away from the lecture, though, isn't it? Because the entire way a university operates is built around them. So you've got timetabling, you've got semesters, you've got lecture theatres. So it's quite a significant jump you're talking about there.
It would be gradual, I think. But I think the first year is where I would start looking at it, because just in terms of effectiveness and whether we're preparing students the right way in those first year courses, I'm really worried about it.
Yeah. So moving on into educators, obviously things are going to change. You've talked already about the significant shift toward blended learning, and I agree with you, it's probably inevitable now. What's your advice to educators seeking to maintain their skills, maintain their teaching abilities in a post-COVID world?
Well, I mentioned that I think it would be good for every instructor to have some kind of learning plan. It doesn't have to be terribly formal, but it should be something that they're thinking about. How do I improve my teaching each year? I think, secondly, we need to look at the reward system, what drives academic behavior. At the moment, I think we have an imbalance between research and teaching. I think that institutions are so keen to get research money in, and faculty are so keen, that's how their promotion is driven, is really by their research rather than their teaching. And I think we're going to have to switch that a little bit. I think research is still important. I don't want to. Some institutions like University of British Columbia have tenure track teaching positions, but there's only about 100 out of a couple of thousand instructors have those. And I'm not sure it's a good idea to separate research from teaching anyway. I think every higher education person should have a research interest in their subject area. But do we need everybody to go for these huge research grants and so on, and, you know, the really competitive situation in research? I think we have a lot of very bad research being done because people just feel they have to do it, and even if they're not very good at it, because they can't be advanced. Yeah. And so unless we have more recognition of good teaching in our institutions, so then why would faculty change? They're not going to change if that's not going to help them get better jobs and so on, and promotion. You see, it's more than just online learning. If you look at things like virtual reality, for instance, that's campus-based. It's not necessarily distance learning, but it is digital learning. And I think we're seeing already an expansion of serious games and virtual reality. Virtual reality has some very interesting applications. It's a much more interesting area than artificial intelligence in higher education, for reasons I could go into. And serious games are beginning to take off because they're good for teaching those high-level skills of problem-solving, critical thinking, creativity, and so on. So the reason for moving into digital learning is because it's preparing students with the skills they're going to need when they leave university. They're going to have to deal with the kind of issues that those technologies enable them to practice, for instance.
Yeah. Tony, I'm intrigued by what you mentioned earlier about a university employing 10 instructional designers. Do you think working with instructional designers is something that educators will need to get used to as well?
Absolutely. I think we'll need to use instructional designers a little bit differently than we've been using up to now. I see a greater use of templates, for instance, for course design, a variety of templates the faculty can choose from or amend according to their own subject area.
Yeah.
But somebody has to design those templates, and that would be an instructional designer. So I think we've got to move away from that one-on-one relationship between an instructor designer and an instructor. That's just not scalable. There may be occasions when you need to do that, but as a general model, I think we have to move away from that. So what that would mean is that instructional designers should live by what they teach, and that is prepare a lot of materials, self-instructional materials that faculty can just look up when they need them. Obvious examples is how to do a short video, for instance. If you have to have a video, what are the design features? UBC has a very nice site where it gives guidelines on developing instructional media or videos, and it also provides the research on which that advice is based. So if faculty say, well, why should I keep my lecture to 12 to 15 minutes? You can go to the research that shows why that's the best way to use video, for instance. So I see instructional designers designing a lot of material like that. I see open education resources being critical too, so that we don't need to create everything from scratch. We can share open education resources across institutions. So I think there's a lot of opportunities here for on-demand, just-in-time training for faculty, but so long as it's part of an overall learning plan for that faculty member.
Yeah. Moving on into the meso level, the universities themselves, what changes do you think they will need to consider as the world moves forward into post-COVID?
Well, every university needs a plan, a plan for not just digital learning, but a plan for where it wants to go with its teaching. And that plan has to vary from department to department. For instance, if we think that blended learning is the route to go, at what speed should we get there? What can we manage? How fast can we expand this area and take into account the need for faculty development, et cetera? Taking into account, you need to identify the areas, what are the priority areas, if you like, where it will work best quickly. So every institution really needs a curriculum design and development plan, department by department, about where that institution needs to go. One thing that needs to be looked at is what is the right mix for different kinds of students of online and blended learning, for instance. I've already mentioned, I think first-year students are not the best students for fully online. Yeah. But could we start integrating some online learning in that first-year experience? Now, I don't mean having a very heavily blended learning. I'd suggest, say, two-thirds face-to-face and maybe stuff done online. Now, students are already doing that informally. But can you build that into the curriculum design so that students get exposed to online learning and have to bring the work back into class so they're held responsible for it, so they learn the skill of independent learning, being responsible for taking on some aspects of learning themselves? So, and then maybe you might want to have at least half your courses in the fourth year or the last year of undergraduate studies fully online, because that gives students a lot of flexibility. They can get some work experience, or they can get through their required list of courses quicker. because they can take on extra courses if they want to. So they have some choice on this. Maybe a majority of graduate programs, particularly the professional master's programs, will be primarily online. And a department should have a plan for this. It should have a kind of rationale for what its mix of face-to-face and online should be over the next 5 years.
I'm really intrigued by your answer there, because it's not a case of you should consider whether. It's really a case of you need a plan of how to.
And there's another issue here too about curriculum planning, and that's about skills development. Let's take critical thinking, because I think every university professor worth their salt is going to say, well, I teach critical thinking in my subject. So first of all, how do you measure that? And secondly, how do you progress it as the student goes through a program? So how do you make sure that their critical thinking in history, by the time they get to graduation, is better than it was when they came in the first year? How do you measure that, and how do you ensure that's actually happening? And can you set it up in such a way that they'll continue to think critically and improve their critical thinking after they leave? And we don't do that, really. We don't sit down and write down these. We might write them down as learning outcomes, but we don't look at the progression, because you're handing students over from one instructor to another. So each instructor needs to know what the other instructor has done and what level the students have got to before they can actually progress their own students. We had an interesting study here in Canada where a government organization called HECO, Higher Education Quality Council of Ontario, tested students on three dimensions. Before they started their university program, they looked at their numeracy skills, their literacy skills, and their critical thinking skills. And when they came out, they found that both numeracy and literacy had improved considerably, but they found no difference in critical thinking skills. Now, you can argue maybe they didn't ask the right questions, or they wasn't embedded in the subject discipline enough and so on. But it is worrying that, and they said it's very hard to find ways to measure critical thinking. But if critical thinking is an essential skill, which I think it is in the 21st century, we better get better at doing that. And we better look at how we use technology to help develop critical thinking skills.
So it's really an opportunity to revisit some aspects of education we've never done right, and somehow bring them on board with the online learning advances.
Not because of COVID-19. This should be happening anyway, because the economy is changing. We had a study by the Royal Bank of Canada, which was very interesting. They went into LinkedIn and they looked at all the job adverts and what employers were asking for in terms of qualifications. Yeah. And so they had a very large sample that used artificial intelligence to organize and analyze these. And they came out with a list of what they call transversal skills. That first of all, they said that 50% of the jobs that exist today won't exist in 5 years' time. They'll be gone. But they'll be replaced by other jobs. And these jobs are the ones that what they call bridge humanity and technology, like helping people if they can't understand how to log in and things like that, but also more deeply than that. They were talking about people who can think and work digitally. And of course, COVID-19 has really encouraged that. A lot of people are working from home now, will continue to work from home. But it was much deeper than that. What they were looking at were things like, can students use the kind of software that will help them in their careers, not as programmers, but do they know how to apply or use these kind of technology developments that will improve their work and so on? And do they have the skills to communicate to other workers, to clients and to customers? Can they communicate those skills very well? So these are the skills that employers are looking for, and they're transversal skills. So if their job disappears, they've still got that skill and they can take it to another employer and it will still be valuable. Yeah. And so if the skills are what's really going to separate people in terms of their ability to get work in the future, then we have to focus a lot more on skills development. And again, technology can really help with that, because it enables practice, which is essential for developing a skill. It can provide feedback if it's designed properly. So there are things in skill development where technology works very well, but you have to educate the educators into how to teach skills, for instance, and how technology can help them in teaching skills. Because it's not something you're just going to learn by doing research in biology, for instance.
Yeah. It's always fascinating talking with you about these things, Tony, because you're not about the online. You really are about the education and how the two can come together to complement one another.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can we finish with some observations about the education system? So how will the ecosystem of education itself need to shift if we're going to be ready for a post-COVID world?
Well, the higher up you go in this hierarchy of students, educators, institutions and systems, the slower the rate of change is going to be because it takes time for these things to work through. Now, sometimes it comes down from the top, but very rarely, particularly with universities, which resent government interference and so on. So, and again, this will depend so much from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I see virtually the end of public higher education in the United States. I don't think that will happen in Canada for a variety of reasons, but the financial pressures on institutions in the US now is going to be enormous post-COVID-19. States are not allowed to borrow money. So the states are going bust because of they're not getting the tax revenues because of COVID-19. So there's going to be enormous cuts to the institutions. So institutions like Harvard and Princeton and Stanford, and maybe some of the very large state universities like Penn State will survive because partly because they've got alternative sources of income and partly because they can rely on high tuition fees. But it will cut through a great swathe of smaller and campus-based state universities and so on, and colleges as well. I think colleges will suffer even more in the States. And that's because of the financial model they've got. And there we might see that two-tier system of campus-based institutions for the wealthy and online programs for the less wealthy. And I think that will be, well, I won't go into what I think of the States, but I can see that happening. Now, the problem with the States, of course, is that the United States does have an influence, particularly on Canada, because we're so close. But I don't see an appetite here for that kind of division happening. So I think it will vary. It might happen in Australia, for instance, maybe not in New Zealand. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how governments respond to COVID-19 and the lessons learned from that. We were already moving in the K-12 system in one province here to having more online learning for grades 11 and 12 in order to cut costs. That was happening before COVID-19. So the pressures are there, I think, to use online learning as a means of cutting costs. And we know that actually, if you looked at the actual teaching costs for face-to-face or online, well, you can design it anyway, but you could design it so it's about the same. But it's not the teaching costs that are the difference. It's the costs of all those facilities on campus that really push up the costs of face-to-face teaching. So one of the things you have to look at is overheads and how overheads are charged and so on. When we would offer the online course at UBC, we were told we would have to pay overheads. And so I insisted on seeing a breakdown of what the overheads were. And when we got to items like heating and lighting and campus maintenance and grounds maintenance, I said, take those out because our students aren't using that. But on the other hand, they've got IT costs that maybe some of the on-campus students don't have. So we got those overheads down from 40% to 15% on a line-by-line basis. So it should be possible to offer online learning cheaper than on campus. But that's because you're not allowing the online students all those extra facilities that students get on campus. So it's not a straight cost comparison. It's a value comparison as well. And that's why I'm really concerned when governments start looking for online learning to save money. And it's a good question whether the public or the parents should pay for all those extra amenities. But I think a lot of students want that. And in a democracy, you know, you have to take account of the wishes of the people here. So I think it's a very tricky situation. What it will do, though, I think it will force people to think very, very carefully more about the costs of delivering teaching, whether it's face-to-face, blended, or online, and what the relative costs are and so on. So I think we need a better understanding of cost structures. And I think that's fair for government to ask for that. I think government should be asking, well, what does it cost you to deliver these in various ways? But we have to be very careful that we also have the value. It's not just cost, it's value as well. I think a student should be able to choose whether they want to be taught fully on campus, fully online, or in a blended mode. And they would make the decision. And we would design courses that could be delivered in any of those modes. After all, that's exactly what business is doing now as a result of COVID-19. They're giving you the choice. You can order online from the business, or you can come into the store and buy stuff. And some people prefer to go into the store and buy things, or the same person at a different time may prefer to go into a store or buy something online. We should have that choice in education as well.
Mm-hmm. I think universities are quite often used to thinking in supply terms, so that they have the way that they work and students need to react to that. And I don't think they're used to actually providing that level of choice or having that demand orientation that you've just talked about. Do you think all of these things will become inevitable as the world moves into a post-COVID mode?
I think it's all right for institutions to say that this is the way we need to teach and we needn't take account of students if students weren't paying the full cost of their education, but they are now in many countries. Now, to be fair, Canada, the students still pay their tuition fees, which are supposed to cover their costs, but they get grants from government towards their tuition fees, or tax relief towards tuition, or the parents get tax relief towards their tuition fees. So there is a government subsidy there, but it's not a direct subsidy. And I think it's the more students pay, the more they become customers, and the more the institutions have to listen to their customers. So I don't think the students should dictate exactly what they should be taught and so on, but they could certainly have some kind of choice in how that teaching is delivered. I think that's a reasonable thing for students to demand.
Yeah. I think we're in for some very interesting years, Tony, as the world responds to what a post-COVID world might look like, especially given too that another virus could be just around the corner. I mean, lockdowns might be a feature of the next decade or so. So it'd be very interesting to see how universities do respond to that. If you had one hope for the education sector, one hope for digital education as a result of all of this, what do you think that would be?
My hope is that more attention will be given to how we teach, and not so much to what we teach, but how we teach, so we develop the knowledge and skills that students need, rather than what faculty are interested in. I think most teaching in university, and it's not altogether a bad thing, is driven by what faculty are really interested in. And what we need to do is to find a way of combining that with teaching that in a way that suits students better than the convenience of the faculty member. And that's a big challenge, I think.
Yeah, it certainly is. Tony, it's been a real privilege talking with you. I always enjoy your perspective. I always learn so much just from hearing you speak. Thank you for continuing to be a leader and legend of online learning.
Okay, you're welcome. Nice talking to you.
Thanks, Tony. That concludes this special bonus episode. Please check our website for more leaders and legends of online learning.
You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.